Welcome to No Ad, No Problem, a podcast devoted to college tennis and growing the game. Select episodes will be featured on the Great Shot podcast feed, but make sure you also subscribe to No Ad, No Problem on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Check us out on Twitter at JTweetsTennis and Instagram at No Ad, No Problem. I'm your host, John. Let's serve it up. Hey, everyone. Before we get started, I just want to acknowledge that this episode contains some troubling language and topics that might trigger people, notably verbal abuse and eating disorders. Thanks for listening. All right, so today we're doing a Hot Topics podcast covering two of the biggest storylines in college tennis. First, I'll discuss the resignation of Texas Tech's women's head coach, Todd Petty, and then we'll turn to the U.S. Open and talk about all the success both past and current college tennis players are having. So first off, who is Todd Petty? Todd Petty is the Texas Tech women's head coach, and he has been there for 13 years. And he's really taken the program to national prominence, particularly in the late 2010s. Under his tenure there in Lubbock, they have won three Big 12 regular season titles, one Big 12 championship, four NCAA Sweet 16s, and they've made two Elite Eight appearances back-to-back in 2017 and 2018. He's really done a tremendous job there, you know, taking this program, you know, in Lubbock to heights that we haven't seen before, particularly from a program with this background. So it was really a surprise in June when he announced his resignation to allegedly focus on his family. You know, obviously, when a successful coach steps down abruptly, it's often, although not always, something suspect. And we got a lot more insight into the reason for his resignation in a USA Today article that was published earlier this month. Before we dive into the article, I do want to recommend that everybody read it for themselves. It is behind a paywall on USA Today. However, that paywall is only $1 for, I believe, every 6 months, so it's definitely worth splurging. But if not, then everythinglubbock.com has been doing a really good job of covering the Todd Petty resignation saga. So taking a step back, USA Today has been reporting for several years now on a disturbing pattern of a toxic culture developing at Texas Tech, particularly with their women's head coaches. Todd Petty is now the third women's coach to resign in less than 2 years, following the resignations of the women's basketball coach and the softball coach. And so a lot of the information in this article actually arose from women's tennis players reaching out to USA Today following these investigations of the women's basketball and softball program. Players reached out to USA Today after the departure of the softball coach, wanting Petty forced out, but not thinking that they had the support of the Texas Tech administration. And so USA Today reporter Josh Peter spoke to about 9 former Texas Tech women's tennis players dating all the way back to 2014. He also spoke to parents of several players and one former Texas Tech employee. One thing I want to commend about many of these student athletes is that they did in fact go on the record. There were 5 student athletes who were willing to go on the record to talk about their experience with Coach Petty. The remaining athletes discussed not going on the record, citing potential reasons like retaliation. So the article first talks a lot about the larger investigation into Texas Tech holistically. It also documents a long list of NCAA violations that Todd Petty had incurred, such as things like time management of voluntary or involuntary practices, strength and conditioning sessions, things of that nature. Petty actually received a letter reprimanding him in January of 2021 about some of these violations and some of the reports of his behavior. The most alarming parts of this article are the allegations that come up from student athletes of verbal and mental abuse and sexual harassment from Todd Petty. There are numerous examples of Petty yelling expletives in players' faces and berating them with profanity and words like disgusting, disgrace. One player noted it was so extreme, it was the first time she ever felt like, quote, she was going to be hit by a guy. And another recalls Petty telling her she deserved to eat dog food after she lost a match. This, expletive-ridden verbal abuse is corroborated over and over by many players, both on and off the record. In the article, players go on to talk about how this abuse contributed to things like eating disorders, and parents of these players cite being so worried about their daughters to the point of being concerned they were suicidal. There are also examples in this article that go beyond the expletive-ridden verbal abuse. There are examples of racist and sexually inappropriate comments. One player recalls Coach Petty commenting on her dating history, saying, quote, "I thought your type was basic white guys, and now you're dating Pablo Escobar." That's a reference to Pablo Escobar, the infamous Colombian drug lord. There are also an example of a player talking about wearing spandex and Coach Petty encouraging her to wear spandex more often despite her preference and her parents' preference for more conservative clothing. I wanted to share these specific examples because I think often just talking about, quote, verbal abuse obfuscates the horror of these sorts of comments and the damage that they can have on student athletes. These are some of the more egregious examples listed in the article. The article goes on to talk about some of the infrastructure in terms of the administration, how these players had tried to raise these examples or situations to administrators and being shut down by them. Since this article came out, Todd Petty has released a statement. You can find that full statement on his Twitter account. I want to call out two sentences here. One, he says that my priority has always been the well-being of my players. To suggest otherwise is untrue. And at no point during my career have I made remarks that were racially or sexually insensitive. So first, he denies these allegations by these players, but he does not deny the allegations of verbal abuse. I found that to be extremely notable in his statement. And then one section of his statement that stood out to me was, "The landscape of women's college athletics is changing. The scrutiny of coaches is at an all-time high." These sentences struck me, and they really bothered me. What about the landscape of women's college sports makes any of this alleged behavior acceptable? And why are we blaming increased scrutiny? If anything, you should welcome scrutiny. You should welcome visibility into your program. You should welcome parents, coaches, players, administrators, knowing how you're speaking to players, knowing what happens on the practice court. I was really bothered by this statement, and I felt like it put a lot of blame on both the student athletes, but then also on the sort of visibility and transparency that is required and we should demand for these institutions. I also want to note that Kansas head coach Todd Chapman, a fellow Big 12 coach, tweeted out his support for Todd Petty, saying, "I have known Todd since 2008 and consider him one of my closest friends. I had the pleasure of working for him from 2009 to 2013, and I witnessed his care and love for our players. Todd coached hard but fair and always had his players' best interests in mind. I firmly stand with him." So I understand wanting to support your best friend, but what does this sort of public statement say to your players, the parents of your players, your recruits? And what does firmly standing with Todd Petty mean? That you don't believe his former players? That this is all just under the guise of coaching hard? I'm not sure, and I think there are a lot of questions when looking at that sort of statement. So why am I doing this pod? Well, college tennis has a habit of pushing things under the rug, particularly things that cast the sport or individuals in the sport in a negative light. This story did not get picked up on by all of the outlets that usually cover college tennis. Yet these are some of the most important stories we can tell. The allegations of abuse in this article are absolutely horrific. These players deserve to have their voices heard. They deserve to have this story told. And it continues to be a shame that it's not picked up by more voices, particularly those in the college tennis community. And not only is the alleged abuse horrifying, but so is the helplessness felt by these student athletes. They had to reach out to USA Today to even have their stories told and heard. The only recourse their administration offered them was transferring. So the least that we can do as those of us who follow college tennis, support college tennis, love college tennis, is making sure that just as much as we're talking about promoting college tennis at the US Open, we're also talking about these stories. Because these stories should serve as warning signs to recruits, and they should also serve as warning signs to hold coaches and administrators accountable for the welfare of student athletes. This article really struck me, and I hope that everyone impacted by Coach Petty's behavior receives the support and healing that they deserve. All right, so a little bit of a shift in terms of the topics, but we're going to move on to the collegians at the US Open. And if you are anything like me, you've been spending all week staying up to date on the US Open. And I think qualifying in the early rounds of the US Open are some of my favorite weeks on the calendar. There are just so many former collegians who have breakout runs or career milestones during these weeks, and it's just so thrilling to watch. And I know that this is a little sappy, but as a fan of college tennis, you feel invested in these players' journeys, right? Just last night, we saw Rinki Hijikata of North Carolina and Danielle Collins of Virginia play under the lights at Arthur Ashe Stadium against multiple Grand Slam champions in Rafael Nadal and Naomi Osaka. And those are the sort of dreams that you have for these players playing in college, knowing still how far away that dream is. So overall, it's been a really fantastic week so far. Continue to look forward to the upcoming action over the next week and a half. But we'll start a little bit chronologically, because we haven't talked about the Open or some of the wildcard discussions. So we'll start there. We'll start with the qualifying wildcards. And so if you've been following my tweets, I had put out sort of a men's power ranking of kind of who I thought was most likely to receive a US Open qualifying wildcard. And sort of as expected, you had Ethan Quinn of Georgia, who earned his qualifying wild card by making the finals of Kalamazoo. And then you had Murphy Cassone of Arizona State earning his qualifying wild card, most likely from his 25K title in Columbus. Now, this year, two qualifying wild cards on the men is less than last year. Last year had four. But it was sort of expected. If you look at sort of the threshold that the USTA seems to have for earning these wildcards, it's typically a really deep run in a challenger during the summer or winning a 25K title. Last year, Elliot Spizzieri, for example, you know, he won his 25K title, and that was really what propelled him to the wildcard. So I think that that was one of the large reasons that you saw the cutoff kind of stand with Murphy Cassone and not my number three power ranked player in Stefan Dostanic of USC. Dostanic had fallen in a final of a 25K. So in terms of their results, you know, Ethan Quinn actually won his first round over American Escobedo before ultimately falling in the second round. And unfortunately for Murphy Cassone, he ended up cramping in his first round match and lost that first round. But overall, a really good showing from both of them, I thought. And excited to see them in the collegiate season. Ethan Quinn is still in the men's doubles draw as he earned a wild card there from his victory with partner Nico Godsick at Kalamazoo. On the women's side, it's been a little unfortunate. There were no qualifying wild cards awarded to any current collegiate women. I thought Erin Cayetano of USC had an outside shot. She finished the season ranked number three in the country, behind Emma Navarro and Peyton Stearns, and she won several 15K titles this summer, both in Cancun and as part of the SoCal Summer Pro Circuit. But unfortunately, she did not receive a qualifying wild card. In the end, there were seven former collegians to advance out of qualifying. You had Fernanda Contreras of Vanderbilt, Catherine Harris of UCLA, Chris Eubanks of Georgia Tech, Nuno Borges of Mississippi State, Brandon Holt of USC, Alex Richard of Virginia, and then lastly, Leola Jingjin of three-school fame, Baylor, Arkansas, and Lynn University, Division II. I think the storylines that stood out for me from qualifying were certainly Fernanda Contreras of Vanderbilt. She has now qualified for three straight Grand Slams. She's 9-0 in Grand Slam qualifying. Really impressive run for her. Also, shout out to Brandon Holt for competing in their first Grand Slam main draw. Ultimately, these seven qualifiers brought us to a total of 23 former collegians in the U.S. Open singles draw. That was 17 men and 6 women. This is an increase from 21 last season when I started keeping closer tabs on all this stuff. So really nice to see that sort of bump. And it's awesome to see more recent guys break through. You know, on Monday, in first round action, you had 4 former collegiate men advance to the second round, all of whom had helped their teams make the NCAA team quarterfinal in 2018. You had Brandon Holt of USC, Nuno Borges of Mississippi State, J.J. Wolf of Ohio State, and Arthur Rindernesh of Texas A&M. So it's no longer, you know, Isner and Anderson and Stevie Johnson. Obviously, some of those players are still on tour, but you know, we're starting to see these players who just within the last years, right, have had success in college are now making that big jump to be some of the top 100 players in the world. So really exciting to see as a college tennis fan. I'll continue to monitor all of the success for former collegiate players moving on into round 2 and beyond. So look out on Twitter for those updates. Also on Instagram at noadnoproblem. I'll be posting there those as well. And lastly, just to close out, I wanted to briefly talk about wildcards. So I know there's been a lot of wildcard discussion. I was really disappointed in the USTA's decision not to award Richard Ciamara of Texas and Jada Daniel of North Carolina State doubles wildcards into the US Open. They both won the NCAA doubles title earlier this year, and they both won with a non-American partner. And so the precedent that the USTA has now set is more or less if you win it with 2 Americans, they'll give you a wild card. If you win it as 2 non-Americans, you're SOL. And if it's a mixed couple where it's 1 American, 1 non-American, you're also SOL. And I think there are a lot of ways to make up for this, right? For example, you could have partnered Jada Daniel with Peyton Stearns or any other American woman to reward this sort of collegiate double success. I think what's so interesting is there's so many former collegiate players within the doubles ranks, right? That's actually where more players are having success, is that collegiate pipeline from doubles. And I think it's a shame not to award them the same way that you award the American winners in singles. The USTA did, however, give Ciamara and Jada Daniel a mixed wild card together, so they will face off against American couple Madison Keys and Bjorn Frantangelo. On the singles side, both Ben Shelton and Peyton Stearns played great matches in their first rounds, but both fell in, you know, when going the distance. You know, Ben lost in 5 sets, Peyton lost in 3 to the number 28 seed, and the streak lives on. It has been quite some time since an NCAA wild card did in fact win a main draw match at the US Open. It hasn't happened on the men's side since Steve Johnson in 2012, and hasn't happened on the women's side since Bea Bielik of Wake Forest in 2002. And given that streak, I am a little concerned that that wild card is in a precarious position. And I worry that the move to the fall, moving NCAAs to a November timeline, sort of creates a permission structure for the USTA to revoke the wild card or at least put some guardrails in place around it. For example, maybe if you win the NCAAs in November, you have to achieve some X pro ranking in order to earn yourself the US Open wild card. So I think that's something to watch out for. I'm not sure what conversations the ITA, the NCAA, and the USTA have been having with regards to the wild card. But that's pretty much it. A quick wrap up of kind of all of the excitement happening at the US Open for current and past collegians. Be on the lookout for more stuff, as I mentioned, on Twitter at JTweetsTennis and Instagram at NoAdNoProblem. Also, college tennis is around the corner. You know, most schools are back in session. Fall events are going to be kicking off soon. So look out for more content as we preview the upcoming collegiate season, talk about some of the players to watch this fall season, incoming freshmen that we should have our eye on, and so much more. So thanks everybody for listening. Hope you have a great Labor Day weekend and enjoy the rest of the US Open.